Rescue. Ligon, Jenner. His contributions to meteorology, however, although considerable, pale before what has ever since been known as the Ligon controversy. That his actions helped to place Harry Seldon in jeopardy is undisputable, but argument rages, and has always raged, as to whether those actions were the result of unintentional circumstance or part of a deliberate conspiracy. Passions have been raised on both sides, and even the most elaborate studies have come to no definite conclusions. Nevertheless, the suspicions that were raised helped poison Ligon's career and private life in the years that followed. Encyclopedia Galactica. 25. It was not quite the end of daylight when Doris Venabili sought out Jenner Ligon. He answered her rather anxious greeting with a grunt and a brief nod.
"Will," she said a trifle impatiently, "how was he?"
Ligon, who was entering data into his computer, said, "How was who?"
"My library student, Harry. Dr. Harry Seldon. He went up with you. Was he any help to you?"
Ligon removed his hands from the keys of his computer and swiveled about. "That Heliconian fellow? He was of no use at all. Showed no interest whatever. He kept looking at the scenery when there was no scenery to look at. A real oddball. Why did you want to send him up?"
"It wasn't my idea. He wanted to. I can't understand it. He was very interested. Where is he now?"
Ligon shrugged. "How would I know? Somewhere around."
"Where did he go after he came down with you? Did he say?"
"He didn't come down with us. I told you, he wasn't interested."
"Then when did he come down?"
"I don't know. I wasn't watching him. I had an enormous amount of work to do. There must have been a windstorm and some sort of downpour about 2 days ago, and neither was expected. Nothing our instrument showed offered a good explanation for it, or for the fact that some sunshine we were expecting today didn't appear. Now I'm trying to make sense of it, and you're bothering me."
"You mean you didn't see him go down?"
"Look, he wasn't on my mind. The idiot wasn't correctly dressed, and I could see that inside of half an hour he wasn't going to be able to take the cold. I gave him a sweater, but that wasn't going to help much for his legs and feet. So I left the elevator open for him, and I told him how to use it, and explained that it would take him down and then return automatically. It was all very simple, and I'm sure he did get cold, and he did go down, and the elevator did come back, and then, eventually, we all went down."
"But you don't know exactly when he went down."
"No, I don't. I told you, I was busy. He certainly wasn't up there when we left, though, and by that time twilight was coming on, and it looked as though it might sleet. So he had to have gone down."
"Did anyone else see him go down?"
"I don't know. Clausia may have. She was with him for a while. Why don't you ask her?" Doris found Clausia in her quarters, just emerging from a hot shower.
"It was cold up there," she said.
Doris said, "Were you with Harry Seldon, upper side?"
Clausia said, eyebrows lifting,
"Yes, for a while. He wanted to wander about and ask questions about the vegetation up there. He's a sharp fellow, Doris. Everything seemed to interest him. So I told him what I could till Ligon called me back. He was in one of his knock-your-head-off tempers. The weather wasn't working, and he..."
Doris interrupted.
"Then you didn't see Harry go down in the elevator?"
"I didn't see him at all after Ligon called me over. But he has to be down here. He wasn't up there when we left." but I can't find him anywhere.
Clausia looked perturbed.
Really? But he's got to be somewhere down here.
No, he doesn't have to be somewhere down here, said Doris, her anxiety growing. What if he's still up there?
That's impossible. He wasn't. Naturally, we looked about for him before we left. Flagon had shown him how to go down. He wasn't properly dressed, and it was rotten weather. Flagon told him if he got cold, not to wait for us.
He was getting cold, I know.
So what else could he do but go down?
But no one saw him go down. Did anything go wrong with him up there?
Nothing. Not while I was with him. He was perfectly fine, except that he had to be cold, of course.
Doris, by now quite unsettled, said, Since no one saw him go down, he might still be up there. Shouldn't we go up and look?
Clausius said nervously, I told you, we looked around before we went down. It was still quite light, and he was nowhere in sight.
Let's look anyway.
But I can't take you up there. I'm just an intern, and I don't have the combination for the upper side dome opening. You'll have to ask Dr. Leggan.
26. Doris Van Ebbele knew that Leggan would not willingly go upper side now. He would have to be forced. First, she checked the library and the dining areas again. Then she called Selden's room. Finally, she went up there and signaled at the door. When Selden did not respond, she had the floor manager open it. He wasn't there. She questioned some of those who, over the last few weeks, had come to know him. No one had seen him. Well, then, she would make Leggan take her upper side. By now, though, it was night. He would object strenuously. And how long could she spend arguing if Harry Selden was trapped up there on a freezing night with sleet turning to snow? A thought occurred to her, and she rushed to the small university computer, which kept track of the doings of the students, faculty, and service staff. Her fingers flew over the keys, and she soon had what she wanted. There were three of them in another part of the campus. She signed out for a small glide cart to take her over and found the domicile she was looking for. Surely, one of them would be available, or findable. Fortune was with her. The first door at which she signaled was answered by a query light. She punched in her identification number, which included her department affiliation. The door opened, and a plump, middle-aged man stared out at her. He had obviously been washing up before dinner. His dark blonde hair was askew, and he was not wearing any upper garment. He said, Sorry, you catch me at a disadvantage. What can I do for you, Dr. Van Ebbele? She said a bit breathlessly, You're Rogan Banastra, the chief seismologist, aren't you?
Yes.
This is an emergency. I must see the seismological records for Upperside for the last few hours.
Banastra stared at her. Why? Nothing's happened. I'd know if it had. The seismograph would inform us.
I'm not talking about a meteoric impact.
Neither am I. We don't need a seismograph for that. I'm talking about gravel, pinpoint fractures. Nothing today.
Not that either. Please, take me to the seismograph and read it for me. This is life or death.
I have a dinner appointment.
I said life or death, and I mean it.
Banastra said, I don't see... But he faded out under Dora's glare. He wiped his face, left quick word on his message relay, and struggled into a shirt. They half ran, under Dora's pitiless urging, to the small, squat seismology building.
Doris, who knew nothing about seismology, said,
Down? We're going down?
Below the inhabited levels, of course. The seismograph has to be fixed to bedrock and be removed from the constant clamor and vibration of the city levels.
But how can you tell what's happening upper side from down here?
The seismograph is wired to a set of pressure transducers located within the thickness of the dome. The impact of a speck of grit will send the indicator skittering off the screen. We can detect the flattening effect on the dome of a high wind. We can...
Yes, yes, said Doris impatiently.
She was not here for a lecture on the virtues and refinements of the instruments.
Can you detect human footsteps?
Human footsteps? Fenestra looked confused. That's not likely, upper side.
Of course it's likely. There were a group of meteorologists upper side this afternoon.
Oh, well, footsteps would scarcely be noticeable.
It would be noticeable if you looked hard enough, and that's what I want you to do.
Fenestra might have resented the firm note of command in her voice, but if so, he said nothing. He touched a contact, and the computer screen jumped to life. At the extreme right center, there was a fat spot of light, from which a thin horizontal line stretched to the left limit of the screen. There was a tiny wriggle to it, a random, non-repetitive series of little hiccups, and these moved steadily leftward. It was almost hypnotic in its effect on Doris. Fenestra said, That's as quiet as it can possibly be. Anything you see is the result of changing air pressure above. Raindrops, maybe. The distant whir of machinery. There's nothing up there.
All right. But what about a few hours ago? Check on the records at 1500 today, for instance. Surely you have some recordings.
Fenestra gave the computer its necessary instructions, and for a second or two there was wild chaos on the screen. Then it settled down, and again the horizontal line appeared. I'll sensitize it to maximum, muttered Fenestra. There were now pronounced hiccups, and as they staggered leftward, they changed in pattern markedly.
What's that? Said Doris. Tell me.
Since you say there were people up there, Venabili, I would guess they were footsteps, the shifting of weight, the impact of shoes. I don't know that I would have guessed it if I hadn't known about the people up there. It's what we call a benign vibration, not associated with anything we know to be dangerous.
Can you tell how many people are present?
Certainly not by eye. You see, we're getting a resultant of all the impacts.
You say, not by eye. Can the resultant be analyzed into its components by the computer?
I doubt it. These are minimal effects, and you have to allow for the inevitable noise. The results would be untrustworthy.
Well then, move the time forward till the footstep indications stop. Can you make it fast forward, so to speak?
If I do, the kind of fast forward you're speaking of, then it will all just blur into a straight line with a slight haze above and below. What I can do is move it forward in 15-minute stages and study it quickly before moving on.
Good. Do that.
Both watched the screen until Fenestra said, There's nothing there now, see? There was again a line with nothing but tiny, uneven hiccups of noise.
When did the footsteps stop?
2 hours ago, a trifle more.
And when they stopped, were there fewer than there were earlier?
Fenestra looked mildly outraged. I couldn't tell. I don't think the finest analysis could make a certain decision. Doris pressed her lips together. Then she said, Are you testing a transducer, is that what you called it, near the meteorological outlet?
Yes, that's where the instruments are, and that's where the meteorologist would have been.
Then, unbelievingly,
Do you want me to try others in the vicinity, one at a time?
No, stay on this one. But keep on going forward at 15-minute intervals. One person may have been left behind and may have made his way back to the instruments.
Fenestra shook his head and muttered something under his breath. The screen shifted again, and Doris said sharply,
What's that?
She was pointing.
I don't know. Noise.
No, it's periodic. Could it be a single person's footsteps?
Sure, but it could be a dozen other things, too.
It's coming along at about the time of footsteps, isn't it?
Then, after a while, she said,
Push it forward a little.
He did. And when the screen settled down, she said,
Aren't those unevennesses getting bigger?
Possibly. We can measure them.
We don't have to. You can see they're getting bigger. The footsteps are approaching the transducer. Go forward again. See when they stop.
After a while, Banastra said, They stopped 20 or 25 minutes ago. Then cautiously, whatever they are.
They're footsteps, said Doris with mountain-moving conviction. There's a man up there, and while you and I have been fooling around here, he's collapsed, and he's going to freeze and die. Now don't say, whatever they are, just call meteorology and get me Jannar Lagan. Life or death, I tell you. Say so.
Banastra, lips quivering, had passed the stage where he could possibly resist anything this strange and passionate woman demanded. It took no more than 3 minutes to get Lagan's hologram on the message platform. He had been pulled away from his dinner table. There was a napkin in his hand and a suspicious greasiness under his lower lip. His long face was set in a fearful scowl. Life or death? What is this? Who are you? Then his eye caught Doris, who had moved closer to Banastra, so that her image would be seen on Jannar's screen. He said, You again. This is simple harassment.
Doris said, It is not. I have consulted Rogan Banastra, who is chief seismologist at the university. After you and your party had left Upperside, the seismograph shows clear footsteps of one person still there. It's my student, Harry Selden, who went up there in your care, and who is now quite certainly lying in a collapsed stupor and may not live long. You will, therefore, take me up there right now with whatever equipment may be necessary. If you do not do so immediately, I shall proceed to university security, to the president himself if necessary. One way or another, I'll get up there, and if anything has happened to Harry because you delay 1 minute, I will see to it that you are hauled in for negligence, incompetence, whatever I can make stick, and will have you lose all status and be thrown out of academic life. And if he's dead, of course, that's manslaughter by negligence. Or worse, since I've now warned you he's dying.
Jannar, furious, turned to Banastra.
Did you detect?
But Doris cut in.
He told me what he detected, and I've told you. I do not intend to allow you to bulldoze him into confusion. Are you coming now?
Has it occurred to you that you may be mistaken? Said Jannar, thin-lipped. Do you know what I can do to you if this is a mischievous false alarm? Loss of status works both ways.
Murder doesn't, said Doris. I'm ready to chance a trial for malicious mischief. Are you ready to chance a trial for murder?
Jannar reddened, perhaps more at the necessity of giving in than at the threat. I'll come, but I'll have no mercy on you, young woman, if your student eventually turns out to have been safe within the dome these past 3 hours.
27.
The three went up the elevator in an inimical silence.
Ligon had eaten only part of his dinner and had left his wife at the dining area without adequate explanation. But Estra had eaten no dinner at all and had possibly disappointed some woman companion, also without adequate explanation. Doris Venabili had not eaten either, and she seemed the most tense and unhappy of the three. She carried a thermal blanket and two photonic founts.
When they reached the entrance to Upperside, Ligon, jaw muscles tightening, entered his identification number, and the door opened. A cold wind rushed at them, and Banastra grunted. None of the three was adequately dressed, but the two men had no intention of remaining up there long.
Doris said tightly, "It's snowing."
Ligon said, "It's wet snow. The temperature's just about at the freezing point. It's not a killing frost."
"It depends on how long one remains in it, doesn't it?" said Doris. "And being soaked in melting snow won't help."
Ligon grunted. "Well, where is he?" He stared resentfully out into utter blackness, made even worse by the light from the entrance behind him.
Doris said, "Here, Dr. Banastra, hold this blanket for me. And you, Dr. Ligon, close the door behind you without locking it."
"There's no automatic lock on it. Do you think we're foolish?"
"Perhaps not. But you can lock it from the inside and leave anyone outside unable to get into the dome."
"If someone's outside, point him out. Show him to me," said Ligon.
"He could be anywhere."
Doris lifted her arms with a photonic fount circling each wrist.
"We can't look everywhere," mumbled Banastra miserably.
The founts blazed into light, spraying in every direction. The snowflakes glittered like a vast mob of fireflies, making it even more difficult to see.
"The footsteps were getting steadily louder," said Doris. "He had to be approaching the transducer. Where would it be located?"
"I haven't any idea," snapped Ligon. "That's outside my field and my responsibility."
"Dr. Banastra?"
Banastra's reply was hesitant. "I don't really know. To tell you the truth, I've never been up here before. It was installed before my time. The computer knows, but we never thought to ask it that. I'm cold, and I don't see what use I am up here."
"You'll have to stay up here for a while," said Doris firmly. "Follow me. I'm going to circle the entrance in an outward spiral."
"We can't see much through the snow," said Ligon.
"I know that. If it wasn't snowing, we'd have seen him by now. I'm sure of it. As it is, it may take a few minutes. We can stand that."
She was by no means as confident as her words made it appear. She began to walk, swinging her arms, playing the light over as large a field as she could, straining her eyes for a dark blotch against the snow. And, as it happened, it was Banastra who first said,
"What's that?"
and pointed. Doors overlapped the two founts, making a bright cone of light in the indicated direction. She ran toward it, as did the other two. They had found him, huddled and wet, about 10 meters from the door, 5 from the nearest meteorological device.
Doris felt for his heartbeat, but it was not necessary, for responding to her touch, Selden stirred and whimpered.
"Give me the blanket, Dr. Vanastra," said Doris in a voice that was faint with relief.
She flapped it open and spread it out in the snow.
"Lift him onto it carefully, and I'll wrap him. Then we'll carry him down."
In the elevator, vapors were rising from the wrapped Selden as the blanket warmed to blood temperature. Doris said,
"Once we have him in his room, Dr. Lagan, you get a doctor, a good one, and see that he comes at once. If Dr. Selden gets through this without harm, I won't say anything, but only if he does. Remember..."
"You needn't lecture me," said Lagan coldly. "I regret this, and I will do what I can. But my only fault was in allowing this man to come upperside in the first place."
The blanket stirred, and a low, weak voice made itself heard. Vanastra started, for Selden's head was cradled in the crook of his elbow. He said,
"He's trying to say something."
Doris said, "I know. He said, 'What's going on?'"
She couldn't help but laugh just a little. It seemed such a normal thing to say.
28. The doctor was delighted. "I've never seen a case of exposure," he explained. "One doesn't get exposed on Trantor."
"That may be," said Doris coldly, "and I'm happy you have the chance to experience this novelty, but does it mean that you do not know how to treat Dr. Selden?"
The doctor, an elderly man with a bald head and a small gray mustache, bristled.
"Of course I do. Exposure cases on the outer worlds are common enough, an everyday affair, and I've read a great deal about them."
Treatment consisted in part of an antiviral serum and the use of a microwave wrapping.
"This ought to take care of it," the doctor said. "On the outer worlds, they make use of much more elaborate equipment in hospitals, but we don't have that, of course, on Trantor. This is a treatment for mild cases, and I'm sure it will do the job."
Doris thought later, as Selden was recovering without particular injury, that it was perhaps because he was an outworlder that he had survived so well. Dark, cold, even snow were not utterly strange to him. A Trantorian probably would have died in a similar case, not so much from physical trauma as from psychic shock. She was not sure of this, of course, since she herself was not a Trantorian either. And, turning her mind away from these thoughts, she pulled up a chair near to Harry's bed and settled down to wait.
29.
On the second morning, Selden stirred awake and looked up at Doris, who sat at his bedside, viewing a book film and taking notes. In a voice that was almost normal, Selden said, "Still here, Doris?" She put down the book film.
"I can't leave you alone, can I? And I don't trust anyone else."
"It seems to me that every time I wake up, I see you. Have you been here all the time?"
"Sleeping or waking, yes."
"But your classes?"
"I have an assistant who has taken over for a while."
Doris leaned over and grasped Harry's hand. Noticing his embarrassment, he was, after all, in bed, she removed it.
"Harry, what happened? I was so frightened."
Selden said, "I have a confession to make."
"What is it, Harry?"
"I thought perhaps you were part of a conspiracy."
"A conspiracy?" she said vehemently.
"I mean, to maneuver me upperside, where I'd be outside university jurisdiction, and therefore subject to being picked up by Imperial forces."
"But upperside isn't outside university jurisdiction. sector jurisdiction on Trentor is from the planetary center to the sky.
Ah, I didn't know that. But you didn't come with me because you said you had a busy schedule. And when I was getting paranoid, I thought you were deliberately abandoning me. Please forgive me. Obviously, it was you who got me down from there. Did anyone else care?
They were busy men, said Doris carefully. They thought you had come down earlier. I mean, it was a legitimate thought.
Clausia thought so too.
The young intern? Yes, she did.
Well, it may still have been a conspiracy. Without you, I mean.
No, Harry, it is my fault. I had absolutely no right to let you go Upperside alone. It was my job to protect you. I can't stop blaming myself for what happened, for you getting lost.
No, wait a minute, said Selden, suddenly irritated. I didn't get lost. What do you think I am?
I'd like to know what you call it. You were nowhere around when the others left, and you didn't get back to the entrance, or to the neighborhood of the entrance anyway, till well after dark.
But that's not what happened. I didn't get lost just because I wandered away and couldn't find my way back. I told you I was suspecting a conspiracy, and I had cause to do so. I'm not totally paranoid.
Well then, what did happen?
Selden told her. He had no trouble remembering it in full detail. He had lived with it in nightmare for most of the preceding day.
Doris listened with a frown. But that's impossible. A jet down? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. Do you think I was hallucinating?
But the Imperial forces could not have been searching for you. They could not have arrested you Upperside without creating the same ferocious rumpus they would have if they had sent in a police force to arrest you on campus.
Then how do you explain it?
I'm not sure, said Doris. But it's possible that the consequences of my failure to go Upperside with you might have been worse than they were, and that Hummon will be seriously angry with me.
Then let's not tell him, said Selden. It ended well.
We must tell him, said Doris grimly. This may not be the end.
30. That evening, Jannar Legan came to visit. It was after dinner, and he looked from Doris to Selden several times, as though wondering what to say. Neither offered to help him, but both waited patiently. He had not impressed either of them as being a master of small talk. Finally, he said to Selden,
"I've come to see how you are."
"Perfectly well," said Selden, "except that I'm a little sleepy. Dr. Venabili tells me that the treatment will keep me tired for a few days, presumably so I'm sure of getting needed rest." He smiled. "Frankly, I don't mind."
Legan breathed in deeply, let it out, hesitated, and then, almost as though he was forcing the words out of himself, said,
"I won't keep you long. I perfectly understand you need to rest. I do want to say, though, that I am sorry it all happened. I should not have assumed, so casually, that you had gone down by yourself. Since you were a Tyro, I should have felt more responsible for you. After all, I had agreed to let you come up. I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. That's really all I wish to say."
Selden yawned, putting his hand over his mouth. "Pardon me. Since it seems to have turned out well, there need be no hard feelings. In some ways, it was not your fault. I should not have wandered away. And besides, what happened was..."
Doris interrupted.
"Now, Harry, please, no conversation. Just relax. Now, I want to talk to Dr. Lagan just a bit before he goes. In the first place, Dr. Lagan, I quite understand you were concerned about how repercussions from this affair will affect you. I told you there would be no follow-up if Dr. Selden recovered without ill effects. That seems to be taking place, so you may relax for now. I would like to ask you about something else, and I hope that this time I will have your free cooperation.
I will try, Dr. Van Abbele, said Lagan stiffly.
Did anything unusual happen during your stay upperside?
You know it did. I lost Dr. Selden, something for which I have just apologized.
Obviously, I'm not referring to that. Did anything else unusual happen?
No, nothing. Nothing at all.
Doris looked at Selden, and Selden frowned. It seemed to him that Doris was trying to check on his story and get an independent account. Did she think he was imagining the search vessel? He would have liked to object heatedly, but she had raised a quieting hand at him, as though she was preventing that very eventuality. He subsided, partly because of this, and partly because he really wanted to sleep. He hoped that Lagan would not stay long. "Are you certain?" said Doris. "Were there no intrusions from outside?"
"No, of course not."
"Oh, yes, Dr. Lagan?"
"There was a jet down."
"Did that strike you as peculiar?"
"No, of course not."
"Why not?"
"This sounds very much as though I'm being cross-examined, Dr. Van Abbele. I don't much like it."
"I can appreciate that, Dr. Lagan, but these questions have something to do with Dr. Selden's misadventure. It may be that this whole affair is more complicated than I had thought."
"In what way?" A new edge entered his voice. "Do you intend to raise new questions, requiring new apologies? In that case, I may find it necessary to withdraw."
"Not, perhaps, before you explain how it is you do not find a hovering jet down a bit peculiar."
"Because, my dear woman, a number of meteorological stations on Trentor possess jet downs for the direct study of clouds and the upper atmosphere. Our own meteorological station does not."
"Why not? It would be useful."
"Of course. But we're not competing, and we're not keeping secrets. We will report on our findings. They will report on theirs. It makes sense, therefore, to have a scattering of differences and specializations. It would be foolish to duplicate efforts completely. The money and manpower we might spend on jet downs can be spent on Masonic refractometers, while others will spend on the first and save on the latter. After all, there may be a great deal of competitiveness and ill feeling among the sectors, but science is one thing, the only thing, that holds us together. You know that, I presume," he added ironically.
"I do. But isn't it rather coincidental that someone should be sending a jet down right to your station on the very day you were going to use the station?"
"No coincidence at all. We announced that we were going to make measurements on that day, and consequently, some other station thought, very properly, that they might make simultaneous nephelometric measurements. Clouds, you know. The results taken together would make more sense and be more useful than either taken separately."
Selden said suddenly in a rather blurred voice, "They were just measuring then?" He yawned again.
"Yes," said Lagan. "What else could they possibly be doing?"
Doris blinked her eyes, as she sometimes did when she was trying to think rapidly. "That all makes sense. To which station did this particular jet down belong?"
Lagan shook his head. "Dr. Van Abbele,
How can you possibly expect me to tell?
I thought that each meteorological jetdown might possibly have its station's markings on it.
Surely. But I wasn't looking up and studying it, you know. I had my own work to do, and I let them do theirs. When they report, I'll know whose jetdown it was.
What if they don't report?
Then I would suppose their instruments failed. That happens sometimes.
His right fist was clenched.
Is that all, then?
Wait a moment. Where do you suppose the jetdown might have come from?
It might be any station with jetdowns. On a day's notice, and they got more than that, one of those vessels can reach us handily from any place on the planet.
But who most likely?
Hard to say. Pestilonia, Y, Ziggurat, North Damanio. I'd say one of those four was the most likely, but it might be any of 40 others at least.
Just one more question, then. Just one. Dr. Lagan, when you announced that your group would be Upperside, did you by any chance say that a mathematician, Dr. Harry Seldon, would be with you?
A look of apparently deep and honest surprise crossed Lagan's face, a look that quickly turned contemptuous.
Why should I list names? Of what interest would that be to anyone?
Very well, said Doris. The truth of the matter, then, is that Dr. Seldon saw the jetdown and it disturbed him. I am not certain why, and apparently his memory is a bit fuzzy on the matter. He more or less ran away from the jetdown, got himself lost, didn't think of trying to return, or didn't dare to, till it was well into twilight, and didn't quite make it back in the dark. You can't be blamed for that, so let's forget the whole incident on both sides. Agreed?
Agreed, said Lagan. Goodbye.
He turned on his heel and left. When he was gone, Doris rose, pulled off Seldon's slippers gently, straightened him in his bed, and covered him. He was sleeping, of course.
Then she sat down and thought. How much of what Lagan had said was true, and what might possibly exist under the cover of his words?
She did not know.